Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 29th of April. It marks today 100 days that President Barack Obama has been in office, and we'll be talking about that the first hour of the program. His press secretary, Robert Gibbs, has given the administration a grade for the first 100 days, B+. And I guess we're wondering what you may give the administration for the first 100 days. It seems to me as though it's been a year. So much has been going on in this administration. And a lot of people say, historians, that the first 100 days really are a significant marker for a president's first term. If there are going to be two terms, first term, some people just have one. So it's a significant marker for the beginning of any new administration. We're so happy to have Ken Rudin with us, the first half hour, who will look at domestic issues. The second half hour, the executive director of the National Security Network will join us to pay special attention to Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, etc. Ken is the political editor for National Public Radio, where he directs campaign coverage for the network. He writes the Political Junkie blog on NPR.org, and you hear him on Wednesdays on NPR's Talk of the Nation with his Political Junkie segment. Welcome phone calls for him, and we'll take them early on this half hour. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Hello, Ken. There we go. Hi, it's so nice to have you on the air again. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Happy 100 days.
Doesn't it seem like a longer period of time?
Well, there are some people who say that the last 8 years seem like a lifetime, so right. You can compare two things. But what's interesting, you said something earlier that struck me, and you said that it could be a significant marker, the first 100 days of a presidency. And yet when you think of George W. Bush's presidency, I don't think that presidency was defined until September 11th,
right.
9 months into the presidency. So a lot does change.
Yeah, it sure does. I can't believe all the issues this president has been dealing with in the last 100 days internationally, where the trips have been, the whole financial collapse, the auto industry trying to take on health insurance, and now the swine flu.
Well, yes, and also the Yankees are not doing well, too. So there are a lot of things on President Obama's plate. But it is remarkable. I mean, even going into the election, you knew that the economy was really bad, that the war in Iraq was just, you know, not going well for the administration's point of view. And there was a lot on the plate. And as you say, there's so much more because Barack Obama, a lot of people thought he would do a lot of things incrementally. He would take up health care maybe later after he did this, but he's doing all at once. I think one of the advantages he has is, one, he has high public approval ratings, and two, he has a solid Democratic majorities in the House and Senate. And as you know, as of yesterday, the Senate majority got even bigger. So he has those two things behind him, and it enables him to do as much as he wants to do.
Right. He must have been tickled about the change of party on the part of Spector, huh?
Well, there are some people who said that if Arlen Specter really was going to change parties, he would have become a Republican. And that's a little joke because he has really disappointed Republicans for the longest time. But the fact is he still had an R next to his name. And, you know, the fact is also that if he get, you know, now that he's a Democrat and now that it looks like that Al Franken,
right,
perhaps as of June, June or July, will finally become the second senator in Minnesota, Democrats will have that so-called magic number of 60. Now, I don't think Specter changes that much because he could still vote the same way anyway. But it's still more good news for the administration, worse news for the Republican Party, who's been reeling for several months now, if not several years.
Right. Lawrence Summers said something interesting, that the administration is grappling with issues that don't easily comport with a 100-day timeline, looking specifically at economic recovery. A lot of these are huge issues, and there won't be a 200-day timeline or 300-day timeline, do you think?
No, absolutely. And Barack Obama, President Obama, has said that from the beginning. Do not look, this economic crisis has been long in the making. Do not expect miracles in days, weeks, months, perhaps not even a year. But 100 days was always an artificial timeline to begin with. I think it was Arthur Schlesinger who wrote about the 100 days of FDR's first administration in 1933. And then every president since then, especially in the advent of television, the president since then have been, there's been a report card of those presidents. So, look, nothing is going to get solved in 100 days. But again, it is a snapshot. And right now, if you look at polls, if you look at what's on his plate, Robert Gibbs said a B+. I think that's a pretty fair, a pretty accurate barometer at this point.
And he is wildly popular. Can you talk about that? I can't remember this kind of interest in the first family, the incredible hoopla about the dog and the lovely children. There's something about this whole family that's captured our fancy.
Well, part of it is the fact that very few people knew who he was when he launched his candidacy in early 2007. He was only elected to the Senate in 2004. Nobody had heard of him before, certainly not before his great speech before the Democratic National Convention in 2004. So not many people knew him or his family. Being the first African-American president with two young children, of course, is very exciting for a lot of people. And just the fact, the sight of two little kids running around the White House, it reminds people immediately of President Kennedy in the early 1960s. So you have that kind of glamour as well.
Right. When we look at the financial crisis that he's dealing with, at what point, Ken, does it become his crisis and he's got to make significant improvement or he just won't be an effective president?
It became his crisis on January 20th. There's no question about that. You can say that, well, he inherited the problems from the previous administration, and that will get you just so much and so far from the public. But ultimately, when he's talking about these amazingly complex and historic programs, the stimulus package, the debt, which I think he inherited at $1.75 trillion debt that could go up to $7.7 trillion. So this is his economy. This is his war in Afghanistan and Iraq. This is his administration, and he's going to have to deal with it. He doesn't have to do it in 100 days. He doesn't have to do it in 200 days. The next judgment by the people will, of course, be in November 2010, the midterm elections, and that's when I think he'll have to be totally accountable.
Right, and the Republicans are going to have to come up with some kind of party, right? They're going to have to become a party, a viable party.
Well, that's the problem for the Republicans, because you can just say no for so long, and I'm not just parroting a DNC line here, but the point is there have not been many Republican leaders out there. The Republicans you hear from the most is former Vice President Dick Cheney, whose numbers were anemic when he left office, has not increased at all since he's become a former vice president. You have Newt Gingrich on the air a lot of times. You have Rush Limbaugh on the air a lot of times. So you have Karl Rove doing a lot of commentary. Republicans lack a national leader. Mitch McConnell, the leader in the Senate, John Boehner, the leader in the House, are not nationally telegenic, exciting figures, and the Republicans are going to have to find somebody quickly. And also Michael Steele, the Republican National Chairman, has made a lot of gaffes in his 100 days or whatever the amount of time he's been in office. So the Republicans not only lack a national leader, they lack an argument. I mean, it's one thing to say Barack Obama is doing this wrong or that wrong, but if you're not going to come up with a solution or an alternative, then the voters are left with very little of a choice.
Why is Dick Cheney all over the place, Ken?
I think part of it is that there's a legacy thing that he's dealing with. But first of all, historically, I mean, this is really so out of the box, so ordinary, out of the ordinary. No former president, let alone a former vice president, has criticized the new administration this quickly. Richard Nixon, I'm going to say when Vice President Richard Nixon left office, Eisenhower Nixon, there was no criticism of Kennedy. Matter of fact, during the Bay of Pigs, which was John F. Kennedy's big problem in his first 100 days. Richard Nixon and Eisenhower backed the president to the hilt and said, look, we have to rally behind our president. Dick Cheney, of course, was a target of many Democrats, including Barack Obama, during the campaign. And he feels that the country was made safe by the interrogation tactics utilized by the administration since 9/11. And the country was made safe since 9/11. And according to Cheney, the Obama administration and its policies would turn it back into a dangerously naive and unsafe position.
Do we have enough people in place right now to deal with health problems?
Well, no, and that's what was so interesting about yesterday's Senate confirmation of Kathleen Sebelius for Secretary of Health and Human Services. Not that the administration didn't have a response to the swine flu outbreak and what to do with it, but there are a lot of people at the NIH, there are a lot of people in HHS who have the positions have not been filled yet. Part of it is politics. Part of it is the administration's it's all own mistakes with Tom Daschle and his tax problems, and it took them all a long time to get Kathleen Sebelius. And then Sebelius had her own problems with taxes, with abortion, with her record back home. But I think the outbreak of the swine flu and the fear that many people have about that outweighed that. And that's why she was confirmed yesterday by that overwhelming 65 vote majority. But still, the administration still has filling positions, and they need to fill a lot more for them to be fully staffed.
And do you imagine they're going to move ahead on that pretty rapidly now?
Absolutely. There's no question. And Barack Obama is somebody who knows exactly what the public feeling, the public mood is. And the public mood right now is wariness, if not concern. And certainly in the big cities where more and more of the swine flu outbreak cases have come to light.
Right. What do you think about the way the press is treating all of this? Is it over the top, or is it good information for us?
Well, there's always criticism of the press. I mean, the press was criticized for not asking enough questions about President Bush in the decision to go to war in Iraq in 2002, 2003. So there was that problem. There was a criticism of the press for focusing too much on President Clinton's peccadilloes when there were other things involved. And so there's been a lot of criticism of the press from the beginning, saying it's in the tank for Barack Obama. But I think serious questions have been asked, serious questions about how do you pay for this? What do we do in Afghanistan? What if the economy doesn't turn around? What about the conflicts and the problems with North Korea and Iran and Venezuela and things like that? So I think the questions are out there. And look, if sometimes we do get a little goo-goo and gaga, I'm not sure those the exact words, but about both the dog and the children. And
I love the dog.
Oh, man. Look, I think that's okay, too.
Yeah. What was Paul Ryan from Wisconsin, his comment about more people being familiar with Bo the Portuguese water dog than they are with the Republican budget alternative?
Well, I think Bo has come up with more to say. Although, in all seriousness, Paul Ryan, when we're talking about Republican leaders, he's somebody to watch. He's one of the most widely respected Republican members of the House throughout and regarded by both parties. And if we're looking for future leaders of the party, Paul Ryan could be one of them.
The president is giving a press conference tonight. We'll be carrying it at 7 o'clock this evening. What's he going to talk about? Do you know?
Well, I think part of it is exactly, I mean, of course, he'll try to, let people understand that the administration is all on top of the swine flu. Part of it is ceremonial. Of course, he'll be asked questions and he'll be talking about the 100 days and he'll probably give his own report card. I think it's interesting that the alternative to President Obama tonight is on Fox TV, which has the TV show Lie to Me. So you have a choice of listening to a president or watching Lie to Me. In many cases, that was one and the same thing.
Let's go to some phone calls. Ken Rudin is with us the first half hour. Our number is 800-486-8655, and it's Obama's first 100 days. That's the subject. Zach from Sheboygan is our first caller. Hey, Zach.
Hi. First off, I just want to say, Mr. Rudin, I am a huge fan, so bear with me. I'm a little starstruck right now.
Thank you, Zach.
My major question is, do you think that the fact that President Bush had such a subpar performance that when President Obama came in, the fact that he had to fix his problems directly correlates with the fact that he's so popular because he's the exact opposite and made him look a lot more productive in the same right?
Oh, there's no question about that. I mean, so many Republicans voted for Barack Obama for the same reason. There was a sense that nothing was getting done, nothing was able to get done. And, of course, President Bush was seen as a lame duck for the longest time in 2008. And so Republicans were really on the run. Given the fact that the preceding administration left with such anemic ratings, both Bush and Cheney, Barack Obama could only come into office with high approval. And what's interesting about Obama is not that everybody agrees with this, his philosophy or his approach. I mean, you hear words thrown out like socialist and communist and naive and things like that. But even if people don't agree with his philosophy and his policies, they still like the guy. Every poll I've seen shows between 64-66% approval rating. And that's exactly what he needs if he's going to get things accomplished.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for your call. Let's go to Pete from La Crosse. Hi, Pete.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Ken. Hey, Ken, regarding the Senate race in Minnesota, is it possible that Norm Coleman's career is over, perhaps his only remaining task being to keep Al Franken and one more Democrat out of the Senate? I'm wondering what you think.
Well, it, Well, several, I don't know how long ago, maybe hundreds and hundreds of years ago, there was an election in Minnesota that had Norm Coleman and Al Franken. It was November 4th, 2008. I don't know if people remember that far back. But here's where it stands right now. The Minnesota State Supreme Court will hear the appeal starting June 1st. It will not be before June 1st. There is a sense that if the Supreme Court rules that Franken is a rightful winner, and right now he leads by 312 votes. If he's seen as the rightful winner, the Republican governor of Minnesota, Tim Pawlenty, will certify the results, and then Franken will be seated. There are some Republicans, like John Cornyn and of the National Republican Senatorial Committee, the senator from Texas, who says, no, we should go all the way to the Supreme Court. I think that given the fact that so many people in Minnesota say enough is enough, Norm Coleman fought the good fight, he deserved to have his day in court. But if he loses the state Supreme Court, I think it'll be over in mid-June, and then Franken will be sworn in by July 4th.
Soon enough. Thanks.
Thanks for the call. Considering the fact this has been going on for hundreds of years, why doesn't the Supreme Court in Minnesota speed this up a little? Why don't they hear it now?
Well, it actually is speeded up. I mean, or sped up? Is that a speeded?
I don't know. Sped up.
Yeah,
speeded up.
That's right. I feel like speedy Alka-Seltzer there. But it was only 2 weeks ago that the three-judge panel ruled that, and also they spent a couple of weeks, too, hearing the protests and everything and the arguments. They only decided two weeks ago that they would that Al Franken was the winner by 312 votes. Then Coleman took 10 days to decide to appeal to the state. Yeah. Supreme Court. And so by doing it June 1st, that's really actually kind of speeded up. It, you know, it could have taken months. And, you know, I mean, it didn't have the urgency that the U.S. Supreme Court had after 2000 with the Gore versus Bush election. But still, June 1st, even so it sounds like a long time, it is a pretty speedy process.
Don't be starstruck. Feel free to call Ken Rudin. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. He's only with us for a little less than 10 minutes, so you need to get your calls in early. It's the Obama administration first 100 days, marked today. And we're, you know, a good way to start for you if you're looking for an angle is what kind of grade would you give him? It's an interesting question for you for the first 100 days. Would you agree with Robert Gibbs that it's a B plus? What do you think he should give himself tonight at the press conference? 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program this Wednesday, we will be talking about the swine flu. Ken Rudin is our guest now. First 100 days of Obama's administration. Number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Let's talk about his personality for a moment. Robert Reich has talked about him as being this serene center of the cyclone, this amazing calmness he has when there are so many things for us to be petrified about, the economy and sickness and you name it, and it's all out there. He does have a persona, and in some ways this is kind of the national teacher, right? He is reassuring, which is probably a personality that's needed during these times.
Well, of course, as he said during the campaign, and as a lot of people said during the campaign, we are approaching the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. If that's the case, the last thing you want is you don't want people jumping out of buildings as people did during the Great Depression. So obviously he has to have this calmness. And it's my understanding that whenever he's in a cabinet meeting or meeting with administration officials trying to put together policy, he will listen. He will sit back and listen. Said, okay, let me hear all the sides, and then he'll speak up. He's not somebody who's combative. Bill Clinton was known to be very combative during cabinet meetings. I think George W. Bush was more delegating authority. But Barack Obama seems to be very calm and attentive of what's going on, and then he'll make the call, which is very interesting. But some things, though, regarding this, are out of his control. And I was thinking of his decision to release the memos regarding the Bush administration interrogation policy with suspected terrorists. I think President Obama wanted to put it behind us, but he also has a belief in getting all the information out that he can. So by releasing them, there was a furor, mostly from the left, saying, look, we have to prosecute. We have to prosecute Bush and David Addington and Cheney and, you know, put them all in prison, whereas his goal, of course, President Obama's goal, is to look forward. But sometimes in the name of releasing information, he unleashes forces out there that might be beyond his control. That's something he has to watch for the next 200 days.
Mm-hmm. What about this whole economy thing here? Do you think that he has been criticized by people on the left, Ken, for having people like Summers and Geithner in charge of this, the very people who may have profited from what was going wrong with all of these organizations. Is he handling this the right way? Does he get high marks from the public? Is this a problematic area for him?
Well, I think if everybody feels that this is just such an enormous task, then people are willing to give him some slack. But the point about Larry Summers and Tim Geithner, that's a very good point. That a lot of them were raised on the Wall Street culture. A lot of them worked with Robert Rubin. A lot of them benefited from the excesses and the greed, you could say. There are some former lobbyists in his administration when he promised not to have them. I don't think the public is focused on that as much as the press has been. But again, if the name of the game is results, and there are indications that, you know, some banks are now doing better than they had been, there's some indication that people's earnings are coming back. But as long as people believe that there's an end in sight, a good end in sight, then they're willing to look the other way. But if you asked me about some of the personnel involved here, I would have thought that for somebody who promised as much change as Barack Obama did, some of the people he brought in to fix this problem do not represent that much change.
What about gun control? There have been some horrendous killing shootings over the past couple of months. We tend to forget these. He did promise during his campaign to deal with assault weapons and a ban on assault weapons. He hasn't followed through on that.
Well, I don't know if he actually promised it. I think he was very, very cautious regarding gun control. He obviously was looking at states like, you know, Pennsylvania and West Virginian states that where guns is part of the culture. Even though the horrific, you know, crimes and the deaths and the rampages we've seen in the couple of months, you think would infuriate a nation, there are a lot of people who say, look, you know, we do this, we write off Pennsylvania, we write off states. It's kind of sad to think that politics will overtake the concern about what the public has about guns.
Right.
But given all the things that are on President Obama's plate, gun control is not one of the top 10.
Right. It's just amazing to me. You can have these horrific incidents and not have a serious discussion again about this issue. It's reached the point we don't even talk about it.
I think it's the Al Gore fear. Al Gore lost in West Virginia, which he shouldn't have lost. He lost in some states, and a lot of people blame. There's a lot of reasons why Al Gore lost, but a lot of people think that the gun issue was a big one, and the Democrats are really afraid to touch that. It's the third rail for many Democrats.
Moving us into the international part of the first 100 days, I can remember doing shows not that long ago. Why don't they like us anymore? Why don't Europeans like us? Why doesn't anybody like us in the rest of the world? What's his progress been? He certainly has been all over the world already on restoring confidence in America.
Now, I think that's an A. And I think part of the reason, as one of the callers earlier said, that President Bush is really, you know, go-it-alone philosophy, always alienated the rest of the world, including many of our allies, whereas Barack Obama, I mean, his first interview was on Arab television appealing to Muslims. He had the famous handshake with Hugo Chavez of Venezuela. He's opened up relations with Cuba, or attempted to, at least with Cuban Americans, about travel back and forth. He's made overtures to Iran and Russia. But of course, you know, there are things also that are beyond his control as well, like the North Korean missiles, the pirates, not the ones from Pittsburgh, but the one from Somalia. But also, you know, a lot of things are on his plate. But as the way the world views us, I suspect that that's the biggest change. If there's one way of describing the 100 days in the big picture, it's the American view of America from the world, and that has improved markedly.
I'll bet he never thought he'd be dealing with the issue of pirates the first 100 days. That's one of those that went, oh my gosh, we're dealing with pirates.
No, but I mean, you know, something. There are a lot of things that if you think of George Bush when he was reelected in 2004, and he says, "I had political capital. I intend to act on it. I intend to use it." The thought of what has happened since 2004, let alone what's happened to 2001, you can't even recognize the world the way it is now.
How true. Are you having fun covering all of this, Ken?
You know, I am. Everybody says, do you miss the campaign and stuff? But this is what's good about this is that during the campaign, there are 8,000 Senate races and House races and gubernatorial races and things going on at once, let alone the Electoral College. But here, when you have the Minnesota race, when you have the Arlen Specter switch, when you have the upstate New York congressional race, when you have the Jane Harmon brouhaha with the wiretaps, you can focus on things even better. And I think you get better, more complete coverage. So I think it's just great.
Right. Do you have time to take another phone call?
I certainly do.
Well, great, Ken. Then we'll take another phone call for you. I wanted to ask, too, did he officially have kind of a press conference with Specter this morning? They had breakfast together. What was the deal?
Well, it's my understanding that the president was completely surprised by this. I think everybody was surprised by this. As a matter of fact, every time Arlen Specter was asked about changing parties, he said, no, I intend to remain a Republican, although there were some Republicans who questioned whether he was ever a Republican, given the fact that he voted against Robert Bork. He votes for abortion rights and stem cells and things like that. And he's one of the three Republicans to vote for the economic stimulus package. But then again, he still had the R next to his name. And Arlen Specter was on Talk of the Nation with Neil Conan on Monday, and he said, well, I have a game plan. Now, we never knew that the game plan was to switch parties, but he did allude to some kind of interesting thing. But today, it's my understanding that Specter will be campaigning or talking with Governor Ed Rendell, the popular Democratic governor of Pennsylvania. And if that's the case, if Barack Obama and Governor Rendell are all behind Obama, it seems like what this was, it was not that the Republicans became so conservative. That's why Specter left. That's malarkey. I think it was really self-preservation. There was no way that Arlen Specter was going to win a Republican primary in April 2010, and he wanted to stay in the Senate for 6 more years. And the way to do it, the only way to do it, in my view, was to become a Democrat.
Let's go to Jenny from Whitewater. Hi, Jenny.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm curious about education. I'm an education in early childhood educator, and there are teachers. I keep reading about teachers being laid off all over the country, friends of mine, especially California, Michigan, and I know that was very high up on Obama's agenda. I wonder if your guest could speak to how high that is on the priority list now.
Well, that's a good question. Like with everything else, there are things he's talked about. And, of course, President Obama did promise to spend more on education, and his budget does call for more spending on education. But if we're doing a top 10 list or top 5 list, there are so many things on his plate that there are things that will get pushed aside. The fact that he's talking about revamping the entire healthcare system and, you know, the economy and the views of the U.S. role in the world, it's just enormous, the amount of things on his plate, not to diminish the important things like the environment, energy consumption, and education. But having said that, is it the number one thing? No. Is it on his list? Yes. Do I think he will deal with it and deal with it perhaps to his success? I do. Just that it's one of the things that is on his plate. But certainly more spending was in the budget, and that's the first step for him.
Ken, thank you so much. It's always so much fun to talk to you. You're smart and energetic, and
it's a pleasure.
I'm starstruck.
I already miss Zach, that first caller.
Well, we'll send you tape if you want, so you can feel better whenever you're down. Thanks, Ken.
Thanks, Kathleen.
Ken Rudin, our guest this first half hour, looking at Obama's first 100 days. Ken, of course, the political editor for National Public Radio. You hear him Wednesdays on Talk of the Nation with his Political Junkie On Air segment, and he also writes the Political Junkie blog, which is a very good one if you haven't yet discovered it. It's at npr.org for all of you political junkies. We're going to look at the world. Our guest this hour has looked at the first 100 days in terms of bringing the 21st century approaches to bear on 21st century problems. What has the new administration done to regain U.S. prestige? What about how they have put forward strategies to deal with Iraq? What about Afghanistan, which is a little less clear, and Pakistan and North Korea, et cetera? Joining us now to look at those first 100 days, Heather is the executive director of the National Security Network, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for Heather. So keep those lines open. You know, we're asking a question, too. I don't know why you're not responding, because you always do. Maybe it's a stupid question, but where would you put the grade of the Obama administration? And then you can be more detailed with your answer. Robert Gibbs says it's a B+. Do you put it there, or do you put it lower? Where do you put it, and why? Chance for you to grade the Obama administration on these first 100 days. And we welcome Heather Hurlburt to the air now. Hi, Heather.
Hi, Kathleen. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, great to have you here. Thank you. Well, let me ask you the question. When you look at, and I know it's a simple question, but it gives us a framework, the first 100 days in terms of foreign policy, in terms of his excursions to Europe and Latin America, what kinds of grades are you looking at?
Well, you know, it's like when you get, I think about this as the way you give kids grades in elementary school, and you say there's definitely an A for effort and an A for activity. It's just incredible the number of things this administration has taken on, given all the other things they have on their plate that Ken was talking about in your previous segment. We set out at National Security Network, the organization I run, to make a list of 100 things that the administration had done in its first 100 days, and we actually had to leave some things off the list.
No.
Yeah,
really?
I could take up the whole half an hour walking through all 100 of them, but that would not make me very popular. But they've done so much, and they've done so much in terms of the things you pointed to, just kind of trying to reset U.S. relations with the rest of the world. So A for effort, and incomplete for results, because you know the United States foreign policy is like an ocean liner, and you don't turn it around on a dime. And there are a lot of areas, and certainly Afghanistan is one of them, where we've started to see some changes, but we really don't know yet. It's just there's not enough time gone by to know exactly what they're going to do or how it's going to work out. So one A and one incomplete.
Some people have said that this could be his Vietnam, that things haven't gone well for any other country that's been involved in an occupation of Afghanistan or tried to take over Afghanistan. Are you worried about that, that this could be the Vietnam?
Well, you know, if you're not worried about that, then you're just not reading history very carefully. Mm-hmm. What I think they've done, which is very wise, is that we're starting in a terrible position in Afghanistan, frankly, because we, as you remember, sent troops in pretty quickly after 9/11, had some pretty quick, impressive results, put a new government in place that was much more democratic than anything Afghanistan had seen in its recent history, and had Osama bin Laden on the run. And then we got distracted by Iraq and, frankly, pulled out our best troops, pulled out the folks that were chasing bin Laden through the mountains, and stopped paying attention for the next 4 or 5 years. And not surprisingly, people noticed that we weren't paying attention, and that's the situation that Obama inherits. What they've done that I think is very wise is say, this isn't a problem that's going to be solved with the military. This isn't a problem that's going to be solved by a long-term occupation, because, as you say, the Afghan people are very clear about not wanting that. They've said this is a problem that will be solved long-term by diplomacy, by giving Afghans tools to remake their country the way they want it, not the way we want it, and by a smart military presence that makes sure that al-Qaeda can't reconstitute to cause us harm. Now, have they figured out a way to do that and to keep themselves honest so that you don't sort of slip into a Vietnam-style escalation? That's something that you can't see in 100 days, and that's something that everyone should have their eye on as citizens over the next, you know, 1,000 days, frankly.
Right. And the other area, it seems to me, that we need to have our eyes on is Pakistan, which is probably one of the more troublesome countries on earth for the United States.
Well, the thing people have to remember about Pakistan is that, number one, it has nuclear weapons, which makes it a much more serious sort of level of concern. And number two, it too has gone for the last 7 years where, frankly, U.S. policy consisted of giving money, no questions asked, to an unpopular military government. And if that sounds like a bad idea to you, well, it was a very bad idea. And now you're in a situation where you actually had something of a civilian revolution in Pakistan last year, and people saying, actually, we want to live under civilian authority, we want the rule of law to apply, we want, frankly, the things that our neighbors in India and other more democratic countries have, but we also want to be left alone. So, again, you're in a very deep hole there. There's been a lot of stories in the press in recent days about the spread of Taliban forces, and those folks, the concern is not so much that they're going to take over the Pakistani government, so it's not an Afghanistan-like scenario. The concern is that you make Pakistan ungovernable, and then al-Qaeda and other extremist groups can reestablish safe havens, and Pakistan is a big country, much bigger than Iraq. There is no military solution to the problem there.
Mm-hmm. What about this? It's a little vague, but this idea of restoring U.S. prestige throughout the world, trying to make people like us again. How do you measure that, and has he accomplished some measure of that?
Well, you know, I think the first thing to say is that it's not so much about liking as it is about respecting, that people don't need to love us, but they do need to respect us. And, of course, it's nicer if they love us, too. A really simple way you can measure it is the president goes to Iraq and doesn't get shoes thrown at him. You know, that's one sort of very basic.
Yeah, that's good.
The president goes to Latin America and is actually able to travel freely without, you know, sort of there being so much concern about demonstrations that he can't. That it can't go out. The president goes to Europe, goes to Latin America, and is at the center of every discussion and is involved in mediating, whether it's mediating between Denmark and Turkey and NATO, mediating between developed countries and poorer countries at the G20. Where I think you can see signs of early success is that the United States is back at the center of the action. Now, you know, obviously, again, this 100-day mark is a little fake in a lot of ways, and you wouldn't want to say, okay, fine, he can stop trying and do whatever he wants now. So it's another one where we can say this is a tremendous amount of early work, but the proof, I mean, because the proof is once we rebuild respect in the world, what do we use that to do? And that's again, what the big challenge is coming down the pike. In many ways, this 100 items from the first 100 days, this was the easy stuff. And I say that, I mean, it's been very difficult, and the folks I know in the administration are working 20-hour days, but you know, this was the easy part, and the really hard part is, as we were saying, what do you do about Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran, mm-hmm. the Middle East, trade?
Mm-hmm. And let's talk about Iran for just a few more minutes before we go to phone calls. He really, as you write in a report on this, after 30 years of mutual distrust, the president has reached out rather aggressively to Iran.
It's interesting. There's another way that you could argue that it's just returning things to what we do with other countries where we have important interests but don't like the government. There was a very careful message that was sent both to the government of Iran and its people, and there have been repeated references to, if you open your hand to us, we'll open our hand to you. So, you know, saying we notice that you're there, we notice that you're a great power, we understand that sort of sticks alone haven't worked, but that we're not giving up our stick either, if you forgive me for putting it that way.
Mm-hmm. We're going to go to phone calls, and we'll take them in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. Heather Hurlburt is our guest, executive director of the National Security Network, and she's looking pretty extensively at the first 100 days in terms of foreign policy. And we have an email address as well. The number for that is talk@wpr.org. We're asking you to grade the administration and to look most specifically at international areas of concern. So we'll be back with you in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We want to remind you that the president will be having a press conference tonight at 7 o'clock, and in NPR News will be providing live anchored coverage of President Barack Obama's press conference to mark his first 100 days in office. Robert Siegel hosting our coverage, joined by senior Washington editor Ron Elving and White House correspondent Don Gagne, and the Pentagon correspondent, economics correspondent will also be there. So that's tonight at 7 o'clock. Two phone calls now for Heather. Let's go to Rich from Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Hi. Thank you. This is a multi-course grading process, I understand it to be, correct? That is, that there's more than one grade to be given?
You may certainly do that, Rich.
Okay. I would currently give the Barack administration a C- on the economy, because I think rescuing the banks may turn out to be and the way in which it was done, a very iffy proposition, okay? On foreign policy, I would give the administration an F. That's like AF, Afghanistan, because unless the Obama administration is able to really pull in some allied response or the United Nations, I think it's very gloomy ahead for this particular phase of American history. Getting too deeply involved in Afghanistan. And I think I'd give them a D on workers in the United States of America. I really do believe that, you know, he came forth and he said, we have to talk about credit cards. Well, in a two-thirds consumer-driven economy, if he doesn't have a deep understanding of the wage and salary and benefits crisis in the United States of America, coupled with the heavy indebtedness of its people, I think I'd rather see Ross Perot in office, because as funny as Ross Perot was, he had it right. What we've seen is a giant sucking sound, and President Obama is going to have to back deglobalization of our economy. Deglobalization, that is, an America first agenda.
Heather.
You know, Rich, two things on that, actually, specifically on, and this is my point of sort of when you've done 100 things, things get lost in the shuffle, but in fact, the administration got other countries to promise to give Pakistan $5 billion to fight terror and Islamic radicalism, which is an enormous sum of money that other people are giving so we don't have to, which I think got a little bit lost in the news with so much else going on. Similarly, they got our NATO allies to promise to do a bunch more in Afghanistan, both economically and militarily, which is something that we'd been, as you say, correctly looking for a while and not getting a lot of traction on. So I'd argue they deserve much better than an F, although, again, the question is follow-through. And, of course, getting people to promise to give money is always easier than asking them to make sure they actually do it. The other point that I think is where our foreign and domestic policies come together that you raise is because we are so closely interconnected, there was this problem of what are other countries going to do about the global economic crisis, or are they going to sit back and wait for us to do all the work and look at us and say, well, this is all your fault. You started it. Now you fix it. And a place where I think the administration actually did, frankly, a lot better than anyone had expected was going to meet with the G20 group of the world's biggest economies and saying, okay, now you all have to get into this too, and succeeding in getting them to promise $1.1 billion in new money to make sure that countries that we need to buy our products actually have their economies strong enough to keep doing that. So as frightening as it is to feel like we're so linked up to the rest of the world while there is all this economic trouble going on, you know, the thing I think to look for going forward is do we have a policy both at home and overseas that actually makes globalization work for us? Can we admit that it hasn't always worked for us up to now and do things that actually will make it work for us, or do we slip back into the same situation we've been in before? And there, I think you do see some good first signs, but definitely an incomplete on that one.
Thanks, Rich, for the call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Jeff from Madison, hi.
Hello. I just came back from Somalia on Sunday, or Monday, a couple days ago, after a week with the UN there, and very interesting take on a country which we'd rather not think about. For the first time in a long time, they do have an alleged government, extremely fragile, in Mogadishu. I was not in Mogadishu, but the new president, Sharif, has more or less cobbled together four groups that support him in somewhat of a fashion. Unfortunately, the fifth group is the crazy one, the Al-Qaeda-esque type that would make us cringe from ever doing anything there. But as the Somali UN staff whom I was working with said, they saw this as perhaps a time when they said the U.S. government, they didn't say Obama. You know, it's funny, they're able to make this distinction that they really like Obama. They have real hesitancy about whether the U.S. government, any government, will help them as you know, is reasonable after 20 years of not dealing with Somalia, understandably. They just decreed Sharia last week, which everyone there I talked to, very moderate people, very conservative people, very Western-leaning people, were all very happy they did, because it represented to them some version of order versus just pure chaos, which they've had for two decades, akin to when the Taliban took over in Afghanistan. People were actually overjoyed that they had come in and stopped the chaos. So they saw this as a time when the U.S. government, and finally they did say the Obama administration, could and probably should try to in some way support the government to strengthen it, and perhaps that means strengthen it to be able to do something about piracy or something that will at least draw the attention of the West. but it represents a time now where perhaps we could be doing something. Anyway, I just...
Jeff, I'm so glad you called in and mentioned Somalia, because whenever I talk to national security or intelligence experts and say, what should we be thinking about and talking about that we're not talking about right now, Somalia always comes up in the top two or three items. And I think for most people, it came to prominence with the piracy incident a couple weeks ago. But as you pointed out, Somalia's problems and its relevance for us both as a humanitarian tragedy and as a source of instability and a hotbed for terrorist activity in East Africa and beyond East Africa has been going on for quite a while. And there, I think, you know, the good news is there's a policy review going on. There are people across the U.S. government who are thinking about what they can do. The question that then comes is, how do you rate that as a priority in among all the other things we've already talked about and, frankly, the issues we haven't even talked about yet? And the U.S. government, in a bipartisan way over time, has been guilty of pushing Africa down the list, and then we're surprised when something pops up like Somalia. So the question, which isn't one you get an answer to in the first 100 days, is that a pattern we can break? And can we come up with things to do that will actually help stability in Somalia? And that, I think, is still an open question.
Sure. Okay.
Thank you so much, Jeff, for your call. Here's an email that's come in, Heather. It seems, this is from Robin, it seems to me like he's doing pretty good in comparison to anything I've ever known in my lifetime. Perhaps since he's called us all to service, he should be grading us, or we should be grading ourselves. I give myself a B.
I think, you know, that's a fantastic point, which doesn't get made enough, and especially it doesn't get made in respect to international affairs, where we do kind of have the habit of just thinking, oh, that's stuff that goes on outside the country, we won't worry about that, we'll let the government handle it. But that's a great challenge. And I'm sitting here thinking how I would grade myself.
Right. It switches
and,
it. It's
you know,
good.
I mean, I think just to kind of riff off of that a little bit, if you think about, there's a whole community of relief groups and non-governmental organizations, and maybe folks who are listening belong to churches that do aid and development work in poor countries. Maybe folks belong to educational institutions that do exchanges. Maybe folks work in government jobs that have things to do with our borders. And so, yeah, the question is, what are we all doing to change the tone? What are we all doing to put on the face of the U.S. and the world that we all want it to have? What are we all doing to get involved and ask each other questions and say, yeah, what is it they think they're doing in Afghanistan? What do I think about that? That's a good question, and I think, I don't know, so what do we think? Maybe I'd give us a C. I mean, maybe since you and I, Kathleen, are talking on this program and you all took the initiative to talk about this with your listeners, maybe we could give ourselves a B?
I would do A-. We can always do better, but I'd say A-, don't you
all
think?
Right. Well, since you're out there doing this every day, you're definitely the expert, and I'll be happy to inflate my grade to an A-.
You're doing it every day, too. Thanks, Jeff, very much for your call. Tim from Ladysmith, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think I would have to give the president a D on foreign policy, if not an F. I am very concerned with what's going on with the globalization attitude of our president concerning dealing with nations. I think John McCain said before the election that he thought Barack Obama, President Obama, was naive, and I think he has demonstrated the naivety, especially in dealing with Iran. If we don't deal with Iran within the next year, they're going to acquire nuclear weapons, and if that happens, they're going to take the entire Mideast hostage and control the oil of the Mideast, and they will control Europe, and the United States will find ourselves on the outside looking in, and we will be surrounded on all sides by Islamic radicals from the South American borders and from the Mideast, and I think that is the major number one thing, and I think we need to wake up to that.
And what do you think we should be doing? What kind of policy change would you like to see, Tim?
Well, I think we are, for the most part, acting very naively with radical Islam, trying to act as if bury our heads in the sand and act as if we can somehow negotiate with a country like Iran. Vladimir Shubat, who used to be a former Palestinian terrorist, said, radical Islam listens to force. They do not listen to negotiation. And they have said themselves, we're not interested in negotiating with the U.S. Okay. or Israel. We're interested in destroying you.
All right, let's get a response. We're running short on time. Heather?
Tim, it's important to remember that neither John McCain nor the previous administration came, nor the Israelis, by the way, came up with a good way of how force could solve the problem with Iran. So, you know, the ugly problem here is that there's not a good, simple option that solves this problem for us. Second, there's also the just the sort of fact-based problem that Iran is much more than a year away from actually having a nuclear weapon. The scientists tell us that we've actually got a longer window than that to work out a way to convince the Iranians to rein in their program. So we're actually not at doomsday, and thinking about it that way does make our options seem much more limited than they actually are. And, you know, in fact, the Bush administration did at various points send diplomats to talk to the Iranians. The Clinton administration talked to the Iranians. George Bush the first talked to the Iranians. So, you know, this isn't actually what President Obama's done is return to the way American diplomacy worked in the past. There's nothing particularly naive or radical about it. You know, Ronald Reagan talked to all kinds of repugnant people. So rather than, you know, viewing this as naive and a source of weakness, and again, I don't think you can point to anything that's actually happened that shows that Obama has disadvantaged us in any way, you can think about it as a source of strength. We're a strong country. We're not afraid to talk to anybody. We're not going to, you know, just talking to anyone can't hurt us. It doesn't dilute the very real sources of military and economic power we have. It actually makes them stronger.
Heather, thank you so much. We just scratched the surface here. We'll have you on again, I hope. Thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. Yeah. And hi to all my family in Portage.
Okay, great. Heather Hurlburt, our guest, Executive Director of the National Security Network. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and to Rob Schroeder for producing and on-air producing this program. And we'll return following the news.